Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 3 minutes, 4 minutes after 9 a.m., March 16, 2012. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Thomas, and Senator Egan. We have a little bit of legislative work to do first, and then we're going to go on to the oil bill. But first up will be House Bill 307, the FY12 supplemental budget, and then we'll continue on with Senate Bill 192, the oil and gas production tax. So on House Bill 307, the FY12 supplemental budget, this is the third hearing on the bill. We heard this bill for the first time, the March 13th, and we had a hearing on the Senate companion version, Senate Bill 184, on March 5th. The intent today is to bring the bill back for further review and look to the will of the committee. And seeing no concern from the committee, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee pass HB 307 out the supplemental capital and other appropriation budget with individual recommendations to the next committee of referral.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. Next up, Senate Bill 192, oil and gas production. We're going to start today with an invitation we sent out to four industry support groups to testify on CS for Senate Bill 192 resources. We've asked the, well, one of them is not really a support group, but we've asked the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the Alaska Industry Support Alliance, and the Resource Development Council. We thought that the AOGCC should have the opportunity to come forward, speak on the bill, portions that they're concerned about, and then follow. And then there's going to be three, although they'll be second in the list, but there then the other three support groups. We thought we'd have them be able to come in under invited testimony and put on the record their concerns, both favorably and unfavorably, and their view of the legislation in front of us as the work continues on here at the Finance Committee. And then following next week, we'll have a public hearing on it, which will allow Alaskans from all over the state to come in and testify and call in. We'll also be having next week the three major producing companies, Exxon, Mobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, come in under invited testimony also, and there'll be a little bit more work. So that process should conclude to close of business on Wednesday, and then we'll start, the committee will start dissecting the bill and its component parts and look at the changes that the committee wants to make on the subject matters that have been pointed out by our consultants, the administration, input into the committee, and also input from the committee members, and we'll come up with CS over the next several days or several weeks, depending on how long the process takes. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and start today, I guess, with the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, Kara Moretti, if she can come forward, please. I think I slightly mispronounced your last name, so if you could correct that for the record in your introduction, and I apologize for that. Kara, we'll get that right with a little bit of practice from the
But it's
Chairman.
Almost St. Patrick's Day, Mr. Chairman, so we'll forgive you. Good morning, Co-Chairman Stedman and Hoffman and members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. AOGA is a business trade association whose mission is to foster the long-term viability of the oil and gas industry for the benefit of all Alaskans. Our member companies, as you can see here on the slide, do represent the majority and account for the majority of the oil and gas exploration, production, transportation, refining, and marketing activities in Alaska, and they do reflect the breadth and scope of our industry across the state. We've stated this before, and I want to emphasize this now, especially for those watching at home, that on matters of tax policy, we have to have 100% consensus of all those member companies listed on this slide before we can testify on matters of tax policy. So, my testimony today does reflect that 100% consensus. The adverse effects ACES has had on the continued production decline on the North Slope and its impact on the economic future of Alaska is a critical issue facing this legislature and the state. AOGA and its member companies appreciate your committee's willingness to continue to analyze this critical issue and its goal of trying to improve the investment climate for our state. We also appreciate the efforts of the Senate Resources Committee in trying to improve ACES through the development of the committee substitute for 192 that is before you today. However, AOGA opposes this CS. This CS does not make meaningful changes and will not result in substantive changes to the investment decisions of AOGA's member companies, thus moving Alaska farther away from the governor's goal of 1 million barrels per day versus moving towards it. So I'm going to walk through the components of the bill and AOGA's view on each component. So to begin with, we have decoupling. The concept of decoupling gas from oil is not foreign to this committee. Lengthy testimony was presented in the prior legislative session, and the language in this CS is the same as what was in Senate Bill 305, with conforming language to other parts of the CS, obviously, that was not in the Senate bill last year. But just as Senate Bill 305 created a tax increase for those that produce and sell oil and gas, then so does this CS. But we recognize the need to eventually resolve the concern that combining the value of gas with that of oil to compute the ACES tax when significant gas sales occur will reduce the tax on oil unless they are calculated separately. However, as AOGA has testified in the past, we do not see why it is necessary to find and enact the ultimate solution to that concern today. One could enact some trigger mechanism to ensure that future legislatures will act in response to the actual circumstances that arise. AOGA is not opposed to a trigger mechanism in concept, although our position on any particular proposal would depend on what it is and how it would work. So moving on to the Petroleum Information Management System, or as we've been referring to it internally as PIMS for short, the member companies of AOGA do not dispute that the Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission have valid needs for information from the companies in order for these agencies to do their work. Instead, our concern here relates to other considerations, and there are four of them. First, we are concerned that by creating a petroleum information management system to improve the administration of the oil and gas production tax, that this new section of law threatens to blur or undercut the present clear authority and accountability that the Department of Revenue has in administering the production tax. The AOGCC wields Alaska's police power, while revenue implements the legislature's exercise of the taxation power. There are fundamental differences between these two powers. So, for instance, a state's taxation power can be contractually limited or suspended if the state's constitution grants the authority to make such contracts, but the police power cannot be limited by contract. So we do not believe it would be prudent public policy to mix the exercise of these two different powers. In Alaska, the Department of Revenue is doing its job in administering the oil and gas production tax, while the AOGCC is similarly doing its job of policing oil and gas operations to ensure efficiency, maximum efficient recovery of the resources, and protection of the correlative rights of the landowners. So we see no reason to justify the blurring of the current clear authorities and accountabilities of these two respective powers. Second, we are concerned that this new section of law would lead to the companies having to file information for this system that is already reported to DOR, DNR, and Department of Labor. It is true that the statute as proposed is silent about companies providing information, while subsection C speaks specifically only to these three agencies providing information to AOGCC. But in paragraph B8 on page 4 of the bill, it requires the inclusion in the system of other information that AOGCC determines to be necessary and relevant to the oil and gas production tax and to the exploration, development, and production of oil and gas resources. Our concern is that this authority might lead the Commission to adopt a regulation to require reporting by companies directly into the system. Further, it is made more serious by the broad purposes of the system under subsection A on page 3 of the bill, which are to improve the administration of the oil and gas production tax and to facilitate exploration, development, and production of oil and gas resources. Companies should not have to provide the same information to state agencies over and over again or in different formats to different agencies. Currently, the prescriptive nature of the reported expenses for the production tax would also lead to confusion with what are allowed expenses for tax purposes versus what are a company's total expenses. As an example, currently, a taxpayer reporting information to the DOR must report essentially the same information three times already, once for compliant purposes, again for audit purposes, and a third time for forecasting purposes. So much of the same revenue and transportation information is also reported to DNR. So we already see this as a problem, and this proposed section we feel only threatens to make it worse. Third, as you can see on the slide, we are concerned that the company's proprietary or confidential information will not be adequately safeguarded against unauthorized or improper disclosure. It is not clear that the system will contain only information that is publicly available and not confidential. Again, back on page 3, subsection B of the bill says that the system must include all of the public non-confidential information that it describes, but a requirement to include public information does not necessarily imply the exclusion of all non-public information. So moreover, it is not often entirely clear whether a specific piece of information is or isn't proprietary or confidential, and it could become especially murky with respect to the other section that I mentioned, that AOGCC could determine other necessary and relevant information to be included. At the very least, we believe there should be procedures that would require notice to companies whose information is about to be included in the system and made public, giving the companies a reasonable opportunity to object and explain why that information is proprietary or should, for tax purposes, be kept confidential, and giving them, the companies, if necessary, the opportunity under due process to have judicial review of the agency's decision. And fourth, we are concerned that the proposed new system promises to create unrealistic expectations about public access to certain specific kinds of information listed in that subsection B that I've mentioned several times. Such information includes, for example, exploration work programs and budgets, production work programs and budgets, oil and gas sales, revenue and pricing, and operating and capital expenditures. Whether for exploration or development, a company's work program are private business matters reflecting internal assumptions and expectations about future market conditions, as well as expectations about the results from those work programs. If publicly disclosed without appropriate disclaimers and cautions, such assumptions and expectations could affect the market value of the stock of the respective companies, particularly if the work programs are Alaskan size and scope and could be material in terms of the company's overall business. The Federal Security and Exchange Commission forbids the public release of forward-looking statements or projections without the necessary disclaimers and cautions, which you have all seen several times when industry testifies before you. Moreover, the public disclosure of companies' respective oil and gas sales and pricing would open the door for their competitors either to use that information to undercut their pricing, something that companies obviously don't want, or to use it to match those prices, even though the competitors might otherwise be willing to accept lower terms, something the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Division and the U.S. Department of Justice don't want. And we can't see how Alaska would want that result either. We're not saying that competitors would actually do either of these things, but our point is that neither the SEC nor the antitrust regulators want even the possibility of abuse. So, unless these considerations are properly vetted with the federal agency with respect to this new information system, it is quite possible that you and the Alaska public may be disappointed about such information actually being made available to the public. So, if you're going to enact a system at all, instead of enacting a system without vetting it with the feds, we think, and as a suggestion, we feel it would be prudent for the state to consult with the feds about parameters acceptable to them with respect to the kinds of public disclosures. Moving to progressivity.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just have a question. through the chair, Kira. I appreciate your testimony. I think it's helpful to have it on the record. I guess I'd just like to ask you, and if you have a response, it would be great, to work with your members to consider what possible opportunities there might be for more meaningful disclosure. And I think what happened during the Resources Committee is some very real concerns came out with respect to the Gleason opinion and the proceedings in that courtroom. And an example was given of a menu, for example, and it was asked, you know, would this be deemed proprietary information? And the response was, yes, we have no mechanism at the department by which to determine which is and isn't proprietary. If the company says it is, it is. And I think it made a bit of a mockery of the system on that day. So I just say to you, in supporting your testimony and understanding the very real concerns, I think we need to continue the dialogue and think about how we can get more information, not only to the members of the legislature who have to decide, what the proper tax rate is, but also to the members of the public who I think genuinely want to understand the industry and its economic impact on the state.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I will go back to my membership, and we will see what we can do to answer that question.
And for those watching at home on this subject matter, the Commissioner of Revenue has been working internally on some of the information gathering and disclosure stuff, and he is going to be coming to the committee in the next week or so and going through this issue with us. And then the committee then will take a look at the language in the bill, what the department has come up with, and see what we do from there. So there's a lot of work. Just want the public to know there's a lot of work in the background trying to resolve this by the Department of Revenue, so we can get a more finer point on legislation language if needed.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we look forward as AOGA in reviewing the work product that may come out on that issue. So moving on to progressivity in the base tax rate, the 25% base tax rate is too high. It's hard for me to believe that anyone is satisfied with our current rate of decline at approximately 41,000 barrels per day or 15 million barrels per year. The production decline is greater than it has to be. So again, we believe the present 25% tax rate under the current system is too high. And in addition to the base tax rate, we also have progressivity. And as you know, and for the record, the present tax imposes no progressivity on the first $30 a barrel of taxable production value. But as soon as the production tax value goes above $30 a barrel, the progressivity tax starts taking away a part of that first $30 as well as the part above $30. So a truly progressive tax increases the tax rate for value or income above a certain level, but leaves the rate unchanged for value or income up to that level. Under both the federal income tax and Alaska's own corporate income tax, tax brackets do this in specific stages as one's taxable income increases. The CS before you, we believe, falls far short of reforming progressivity enough to make any material difference in the North Slope decline, let alone keeping production about the same 10 years from now. So the reasons we believe this is, one, the CS has no brackets for progressivity. Number two, it lowers the starting slope for progressivity by a mere 1/8 from 0.4 to 0.35%. And third, although it lowers the cap by changing the point when progressivity maxes out or provides a cap from a production tax value of $342 per barrel down to $201, according to DOR's projections, the Alaska North Slope spot price needs to be about $244 a barrel to reach this new proposed cap. So my member companies believe it may be a while before the taxpayers see any actual benefit from the lowered cap on the progressivity under this CS. And so the resources CS merely goes through the motions of changing the progressivity tax without providing the material change and reform that we believe are needed. Governor Parnell has expressed a goal of not merely slowing or arresting the decline of North Slope production, but increasing the value of oil through taps to 1 million barrels per day. The operators on the North Slope of the large fields have said they see technically feasible ways to have North Slope production 10 years from now at 600,000 barrels per day, which would be about the same as we have today, which would make it easier for new production from the OCS or other sources to fill the pipeline to the 1 million barrels a day level. But what is needed is a change in the tax, so the necessary investments to achieve these great things are possible by making Alaska more competitive. We believe putting brackets into progressivity would be an important first step, although not the only one that the state could and should take to achieve that goal. So next I want to talk about rewarding increases in production, and I apologize, I don't have a slide for this in my packet. I apologize for that. But on Section 13 of the bill, it is essentially impossible when an investment decision is being made to know in advance exactly how successful it may turn out to be, just like we do when we make our investments in the stock market. We don't know what the outcome is going to be, or even if it's going to be successful at all. The present ACES tax encourages investment here by rewarding taxpayers for making the decision to invest here instead of rewarding them only if their investment actually succeeds in increasing production. In this, the ACES tax credits are like the tax credits for making movies in Alaska. They too reward the movie producer for spending the money here rather than making the credit dependent upon whether the movie is a success at the box office. But we do understand how the people of Alaska might want to see real results in slowing the production decline in order to judge how well the incentives under ACES are succeeding in attracting investments here to arrest that decline. So the resources CS proposes to reward actual increases in production from the prior year's level. This reward takes the form of a $10 a barrel reduction in the taxpayer's production tax value for a calendar year for each taxable barrel produced over that production in the prior year. The problem that we see with this is that some North Slope fields may have decline rates substantially greater than the 6% average, historical average for the North Slope as a whole. And so under this CS, even if such a fast declining field makes a significant reduction in its rate of decline from the prior year's decline rate, but falls short of surpassing that actual amount in the prior year's production, there is no reward for this success in keeping production significantly higher than it otherwise would have been. A further problem that we see with this CS is that on page 19 of the bill in subsection G, the proposal would limit the effect of the $10 a barrel reductions in the production tax value by preventing them from being considered for purposes of setting the progressivity tax rate. We do not understand why the $10 allowance would not be applied to progressivity. Senator Wagner, co-chair of the Resources Committee, has proposed a tax holiday amendment and concept to that committee's CS under the conceptual amendments that were put forward that would provide a similar but more effective reward for a producer's success in slowing down its rate of decline. It would set a target level of production for each year by applying the decline rate during the three most recent years to the producer's production in the prior year. So if the production in a year beats the target for that year, the above target production would get a tax holiday by excluding its gross value at the point of production from the calculation of the production tax value for the producer's taxable production during that year. So you would not only have to, you would not have to exceed your production from the prior year, but beat the forecast for decline. This would reduce the amount of PTV, or the production tax value, subject to the tax, and if progressivity were applicable, it would also reduce the progressivity tax rate. So together, we believe these would provide a useful incentive to beat the target. Each year the target is beat, it raises the target for the next year. And for any year when the target is not met, the tax holiday provides no benefit to the producers. And while we have some technical concerns with the particular language of the conceptual amendment that was offered, its basic approach is sound. And to show Alaskans real barrels of additional production, the tax holiday, we believe, is a clear and direct way to show it. So finally, the last section that we want to talk about is the new minimum tax, or the floor. The current version of AS 4355-011F sets a minimum tax for North Slope oil and gas that is based on the gross value of the point of production of that oil and gas, with the rate of this minimum tax being set on the basis of West Coast spot price of North Slope oil during that year. So currently, this minimum tax is payable whenever it is greater than the regular tax under 011E for the year. The resources CS would rewrite this section so that first, it would only apply to fields that have more than 1 billion barrels of cumulative production or more than 100,000 barrels a day on average during the most recent calendar years. So in other words, it targets only the legacy fields, the main Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk River fields, and does not apply to other fields on the North Slope. Second, we believe it creates a disincentive to invest in the legacy fields because it would bar producers with production from one of those fields from using tax credits to reduce the tax on that field below the 10% of the gross value of the point of production for that field's production, nor could the producer use its otherwise deductible lease expenditures for that field to reduce its tax below the 10%. We also concur with the concerns that DOR expressed about these changes. And in addition, these changes do not fit in with the logic and structure of the rest of the tax. Generally, all of a producer's North Slope production is lumped together and taxed on an aggregate basis. This means the tax benefits from deducting lease expenditures and taking tax credits are shared across all of a producer's North Slope interests, rather than setting up potentially dangerous trade-offs between one North Slope field and another. But the new section would require the allocation of costs among the two large fields and a producer's interests in their satellite fields and any other fields on the slope, since costs must be allocated on the two giant fields in order to compare each one's imputed regular tax after credits to the new minimum tax. This will undercut the interfield neutrality for North Slope fields and could lead to undesirable economic distortions and the consequences flowing from them. Let me give you one quick example. One potential area for undesirable consequences is when raw production fluids from one field are run through the production facilities of another, and one or both fields is subject to this new minimum tax. How do the adjustments under current law for payments to use those production facilities interface with the determination of the imputed regular tax of a giant field under the new section? There is no answer, nor even a hint of one, in current law or in the proposed new section. So we believe by limiting its application to just Prudhoe and Kuparuk, the new section singles out these two fields for a potentially severe economic penalty. AOGA strongly recommends against this approach. Remember, I need 100% consensus before I testify on tax matters, and we all believe that if the two giant fields fail because targeted state tax policy against them makes them fail, the other North Slope fields will quickly fail as well. The two giants are the economic mainstay that allows economic success for the other fields, and without the giants, the other fields simply cannot sustain themselves for very long. So in conclusion, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, AOGA's message today is simple. The overall government take in Alaska, and particularly for the North Slope field, is simply too high. It is not too high just for our good, but for Alaska's good. We do support the governor's progressivity brackets and other reforms as important first steps in providing meaningful change and reform. Tax policy does affect business decisions. And the resources CS for Senate Bill 192, as I stated, will not improve any of my members' ability to attract the investment dollars needed to change Alaska's course. If anything, it will weaken their case for investing here instead of somewhere else. The competition for these dollars is real, and it is intense. So we look forward to working with the Senate Finance Committee to change this CS so it will put Alaska in a better and more competitive position. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee for allowing me to walk through some of the technicalities and concerns that we have with this bill, and I am happy to try and answer any questions that you may have.
Just a quick comment on the floor. We haven't discussed it much here yet, and we will later on in more detail. The concerns we have, but we have, in our current structure, no limit to the amount of credits that can swing into the Treasury, and currently this year we're expecting somewhere between $700 and $800 million, and FY13 around $800 or plus million to affect the Treasury. So depending on the composition of our base tax and progressivity and so on and so forth, at lower oil prices, we could have a significant impact or negative production tax value, which has been pointed out by our consultants as a problem that we have. So if we have a solution that you know, your organization feels, you know, isn't as effective as it ought to be, we're certainly open for suggestions. But it has been pointed out that it is a problem for the sovereign or the state to have an exposure that we do have. So we'll address it at some form, but it would be nice to have some kind of some input from your organization later on into how you think the state should deal with it or not. But clearly, by not dealing with the potential of negative production tax value against the state is, I don't think, very prudent for the Finance Committee to ignore.
And Mr. Chairman, we will evaluate the proposals that you continue to work through, and we'll provide input into those proposals.
Okay. Have any questions for? Yeah, well, thank you for coming in today.
You're welcome. Happy to come back.
Yep. And next up, Ms. Kathy Forrester, Chairman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Committee. The new chairman. Chairwoman.
Just the piece of furniture, just a chair.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and then tell us about.
My name is Kathy Forrester. I'm the chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Chairman Stedman and members of the Senate Finance Committee, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, or AOGCC, an independent quasi-judicial state agency, is the state's permitting and regulatory authority over hydrocarbon and geothermal wells. The Commission's duties include ensuring the maximum recovery of hydrocarbon and geothermal resources, preventing hydrocarbon and geothermal waste, ensuring well safety, and protecting underground sources of drinking water and correlative rights. Given the nature of the Commission's duties and responsibilities, apart from support personnel, it is staffed by expert petroleum engineers and petroleum geologists. Because its expertise is so carefully tailored to its statutory duties and responsibilities, the Commission functions well, and Alaska has an unrivaled record with regard to well safety and production. Sections 2 and 3 of the committee substitute for SB 192 seeks to effectuate a substantial change in the AOGCC by requiring the Commission to establish, operate, and maintain an electronic petroleum information management system comprised of available and non-confidential information. The vast majority of the information the Commission must include in this petroleum information management system has nothing to do with the Commission's mission or function. Things like unit and joint operating agreements, exploration licenses and leases, work programs and budgets, development plans, operating and capital expenditures and projections, oil and gas sales, revenue and pricing, transportation agreements, abandonment plans and budgets, resident and non-resident hiring information, training opportunities, and other information the Commission determines necessary and relevant to the oil and gas production tax and to the exploration, development, and production of oil and gas resources. Not only is much of this information not germane to what the AOGCC does, but also much of this information is currently already gathered and maintained by other state agencies who do have these responsibilities. And some of the data is not currently available to any state agency. After careful review and consideration of Sections 2 and 3 of the Senate Substitute for SB 192, the AOGCC is of the view that these sections radically change the AOGCC's long-standing role as the state's petroleum technology and geology experts. They also jeopardize the Commission's ability to discharge its primary duties and responsibilities in those realms. The Commission has neither the expertise nor the infrastructure to construct, maintain, and operate information management systems, computer systems, and the gathering of information on other subjects not related to the safe, efficient production of hydrocarbon resources from wells. Implementation of Sections 2 and 3 will create, at a substantial fiscal outlay, an additional distinct state bureaucracy within the AOGCC, and one that duplicates functions currently performed by other state agencies. The AOGCC's non-confidential information is already publicly available on our website. Other agencies are currently working to provide similar web accessibility to their data. Once those agencies do so, the information will be far more readily accessible to the public on those websites and at a substantially reduced cost. Thank you.
And as mentioned earlier, we'll have discussions with the Department of Revenue Commissioner on the subject matter and see what the department has been able to help us with on this issue. And then the committee will have some discussion on what we want to do if there's gaps and then where to locate it. So we'll keep you informed on that towards the end of those discussions and have your input.
Thank you.
There is a concern, as Senator McGuire mentioned, of the information to the legislature, so we just need to sort this out.
Senator Stedman, I appreciate the importance of you guys getting information, and I hope you can appreciate the importance of allowing the AOGCC to do the important work that we are charged with doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for coming
Thank
in this
you.
Morning. Next up, the Alaska Industry Support Alliance, Mr. Doug Smith, President and CEO of Little Red Services and the Government Affairs Chair for the Alliance. Mr. Smith, you've been here before, so you know the routine.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead and...
So for the record, my name is Doug Smith. I am President and CEO of Little Red Services, oilfield services company here in Alaska, and only in Alaska at the present time. And I am here representing the Alliance, and as we get into slides, we'll cover that. But would encourage the committee, as we've seen each other quite a few times in different venues, ask the hard questions. We're a transparent group. We want to be forthcoming, and there's no question about jobs or anything that we're not willing to take on. So. Thank you. Like you guys, I need time to get my data organized. We've heard from so many third-party consultants. I feel like I'm traveling with 100 pounds of opinions. But looks like lately we spend more time on this than we do trying to operate our companies. So just real quick, we're organized the presentation this morning to try to cover some of the key areas fairly quickly. We had a little bit of background, try to cover some of the real impact and give you specifics to our member companies. We're calling our section observations versus recommendations. We don't actually invest in the resource development, and we don't have the burden you guys do of deciding tax policy. So for us to try to make firm recommendations is a leap of faith for us. But we will give you some observations that we think that are comparatives drawn between what's been provided by third-party analysts hired by the legislature and what we're seeing on the ground at the coalface, the work activity. And then we'll take any questions that you might have. You know, just an overview, as you stated, we have been here a lot. We've come down. We've tried to be participatory in this process, be transparent when asked to be. A lot of us provided very transparent data to the McDowell Group for the job study. We've been here a number of times at our expense. We're not subsidized. We're not paid to be here. We're here on our own time, and oftentimes going back and working weekends to fill in the gap to what we miss at work today. We've advocated for tax reform, and it's not about the bottom line of oil companies. It's about what makes our state competitive and what generates jobs for us for the long term. We do have a lot of members. Their employees have been good. Our members have been good to show up and provide testimony, try to give real-life examples. I sat here through the committee's testimony and resources and heard a lot of the call-in public testimony, took notes. You know, about 70% of that was for some sort of reform that's fair that will keep businesses moving forward here in Alaska for the next generation. And I'm glad people are calling in from across our state and not just from oil field service companies. The McDowell report, you know, did confirm some of the facts we've tried to present. You know, we do fall in the range generally of 70 to 90% Alaska hire. We do have some non-residents now who formerly lived here. I'm in that situation myself with an aging workforce and people who are moving outside for lower cost living opportunities where housing and costs are generally lower and their dollar goes further. And also some obviously position themselves to be maybe live in a different climate when they retire and don't want to struggle with our sidewalks when they're 70. The you know, our employment record on the slope has been a big issue. And I realize that's created some distractions and some political ping pong back and forth between the groups. And you know, the reality of it is when the recession started in 2009, when the prices came down on oil, we did see job loss, and the data of unemployment claims support that. We really didn't know where the bottom was. No one knew, was oil going to recover soon, later? How deep was it going to run as far as the recession goes? And, you know, there was a lot of concern amongst residents and companies where the bottom was. And we really couldn't correlate if it was ACES by itself, was it the economy in general plus ACES. But the real-life story was we laid off 10% of our people at that point in time. We have recovered some on those numbers. But there was a point in time when jobs were a real issue and the data supported that. We have 460 members, 35,000 employees that work with those member companies. It's a broad group. I mean, you come to our breakfast, you hear people from telecommunications to automotive to welding to IT support groups. It's not just direct service companies to oil industry. And we have a lot of mining participation and other resource development. And I think, you know, you got to really get down to our mission statement. You know, it is to promote development here. And the key thing of that statement is to benefit all Alaskans. I think that gets lost sometimes. We get, you know, he kind of label us as benefiting only those who provide services directly to the oil companies. You know, 53% of the donations last year to United Way came from oil companies and service companies and our membership, and it's a lot of money. It gets to people across our state who have no direct link to the oil industry, and that's just one nonprofit of many and many other trickle-down economic impacts that our industry has in this state. It is about, and it is about Alaskans, and we need to stay focused on that. As we've seen in the expert testimony, you know, we're not positioned very well to compete for new project investment. And when you look at some of the NPVs and IRs of yesterday from the PCF Energy presentation, most of those would not pass our financial internal model at our company to get funding. And I don't think we can expect others to expect less return than they can get in other areas of investment. And we look at what the effective projects are. This is a real-time snapshot in Alaska right now. Our three largest fabrication facilities that build truckable modules, pipe spools, you name it, to support project activities are currently today operating at a loss just to maintain core staff. And we didn't use their names here because they didn't feel comfortable putting them out. I'm certain if you call them individually and you guys know who these people are, they will confirm this. The challenge with this is as we erode our base to support projects from the service industry, when and if we get taxes competitive to compete for these projects to bring on additional oil production, it will take some degree of time to ramp back up and support that type of activity. And in some cases, I don't think some of these companies will spend the next year operating at a loss. I think we'll see truly some shift of direction away from this service line if it can't at least be cash neutral in the coming year. So I don't think we have as much time. The service industry, I don't believe, has as much time as the state or the producers to work on this issue. You know, we're looking for work, and there's a whole list of companies that we could use the names because it's public information, who have taken up ownership positions and making investments with resources, staff, cash, otherwise, in the lower 48. You know, you can't blame them for that. I support that. We have to do what we have to do to stay growing or at least sustain our current cash flows. But my concern as an Alaska resident first is that if the tide turns and we become a better investment climate, you know, we've got an X amount of management resources and cash commitment and capital outside of our state now with service companies. It takes some time to get that redirected or grow it to meet our needs here, you know, should we see investment profiles change here. You know, when I read the McDowell study, I kind of looked at it to say, you know, what's the real objective information here? And if did anything really concern us out of there? Was a lot of things that got sort of corrected probably that had been some degree of rhetoric in the past around the jobs issues. But the one that should concern every Alaskan, no matter where you work or what you do in the state, is the amount of jobs it takes to produce a much lower volume of oil. You look at this ratio, you don't got to adjust this for inflation. All you got to look at that and say, you know, we're getting 28,000 barrels annually now for a job that 10 years ago, the study's based on 2010 information, 10 years prior we were getting 108,000 barrels. And when you look at the OPEX expense of that labor to produce that barrel of oil, you know, it's three or four times as much now to get that barrel than it was. And that's an impact to the state and the industry. You know, there is a job loss, and yes, we are replacing some of those jobs. There are not thousands of fewer jobs, and one could argue jobs are actually up recently, the last couple of years. But what we're seeing is there's a competition for a thread of people that are important to our industry here, and they are getting pulled away to smaller independents. If you're an operator company, they're getting pulled away to other contractors for higher pay. And, you know, we talk about, well, really, where is the competition? And, you know, for us, it's not some of the areas that our tax rates are better than on the worldwide analysis provided by these third-party independent reviewers working for the legislature. You know, we're not losing people to Azerbaijan or Turkmenistan or other places I've never even been to. You know, our competition is the lower 48. And in some cases of professional jobs where they can transfer on visas, it is into Canada. And this is an article sent to me by one of our employees, and it's a recent article. It's called Boomtown USA is the label. It's about North Dakota. And what he wrote on here is, you know, why not Alaska? Well, that's a complex answer. It's a simple question, but it doesn't have a very simple answer. And we recognize that. But there is a formula that should change to where we can be part of this and the current oil prices. What's important about this article is to understand is an interview with one of the rig hand, a guy working on the floor of a rig. I'm making $42 an hour. I have great medical and retirement benefits. $42 an hour, I guarantee you, is more than any contract position is paying on the North Slope for an hourly worker. It's significantly higher than my company. And I have employees that have been there for 20 years who don't make anything near that. So there is competition for experienced personnel, and we are seeing that, and we're exchanging that. And if you look at our new hires that we brought on at my company in the last 18 months, we're bringing people on with very low levels of experience, and we're training them. We're hiring for attitude. We're training for skill. It's expensive, and it doesn't make us as strong as we should be as companies in Alaska when we're exchanging out our core personnel for new hires that are requiring us to train them in our oil field services businesses. There's a letter in your committee packet we sent down from our company, and I'll apologize ahead of time. We had some titles wrong. Senator Stedman, we had yours and some other senator titles incorrectly stated on that letter, so we corrected those for you. I don't know if it made it in the, did it make it to the committee packet, the letter. So you guys can read that at your own leisure. There was a key point that I wanted to express. Last time I was here, we missed the opportunity. So this morning, talked about how are we shifting jobs? You know, how are we making up the gap in jobs that were lost to production-related activities? And a case in point for us, we had an asset that was working in Kuparuk that we took offline in 2009 due to the decrease in activity there. And the asset was idled. It did result in the reduction of 8 employees at the time. That was the crew to operate an asset of that type. When we had that asset idled, we looked for work for that opportunity for that unit to go to work. And our units can heat water. We can heat other products. That's what a hot oil unit does. So we found an opportunity for that to go to work in Prudhoe in a maintenance function. And this truck went out seasonally and heated water at a lake in the wintertime, and the hot water was trucked to locations to wash snow and ice off of pipelines for corrosion inspection. And, you know, we were able to restore some of our lost revenue and create some job opportunities. But that's where the job shift is happening, and it's hard to see if you're in Juneau or if you're in Anchorage, where are we shifting from? Away from a unit that used to be staffed and manned, that did squeeze jobs, that did hot diesel flushes, and a lot of things downhole that helped to enhance production, is now out servicing an activity that's purely maintenance and doesn't contribute to the production at all. The broader picture for us is, as we stated last time, you know, we're looking at to decrease our cost by trying to take advantage of the company of some cheaper financing that's available in the marketplace today. And interestingly enough, you know, as we begin to open dialogue with banks to pursue this refinance for our company, you know, banks as far away as New York are asking about our tax policy. This is not an invisible issue just here in Alaska. It's an issue that's got some degree of recognition across the country by folks who have financial interest or could have interest here in our state. So, you know, it'll be interesting as that develops to see how much of an issue that is for them. But our early indication is that our access to low-interest money will be somewhat impacted by tax policy here, which will further impact our ability to generate jobs. So at this point in time, you know, just looking ahead at, you know, what do we think tax reform should address? You know, there's a lot of areas and a lot of ways that the consultants have made some recommendations, specifically Pedro Van Muir's, who presented to the Alliance. And, you know, we don't probably don't agree with his philosophical approach of completely revamping our tax code and attacking each type of production stream with its own tax structure, but there's some important points here to think about as you move forward in considering new legislation. There is existing light oil production inside existing fields. It's very important. New light oil production that could come from additional in-field activities. There's the viscous oil. Pedro calls that heavy oil when he looks at his API rating on that oil. It's viscous in our term here in the North Slope, so we stay with that term as we hit these points. Exploration, and then new companies that are here today that invest in Alaska, or our ability to attract companies to come in and make investments here. So under existing production, you know, what we heard from Pedro's presentation is that the government take of 70-75% is reasonable. It is maybe slightly on the high side. That's from a slide I have with me that he made the presentation to us. I believe it was the same presentation material to the Senate. And, you know, I believe that the lower end of his bracket at 70 is still slightly on the high side. You know, I think we just have to look and say what's happening in our investment climate here today, what's happening with our decline. And, you know, I think he's in the ballpark, but I think he's still a little on the high side. But, you know, I've heard a lot of people say 75% is okay, according to Van Muir's. I just think we need to get on record. He gives us a range, and he states that could be on the high side. Now, you can decide what slightly means, but it could be interpreted many ways. But I think it's, you know, 5 or 10%. New production. You know, I think clearly everyone's already pointed out that the allowance proposed in 192 probably is not going to get us there. And I don't think it has a correlation to a recommendation by Van Muir's that he was saying, you know, a 60 to 65% government take for more costly new light oil resources as proposed in 110 and 17. It seems to be a reasonable level from an international perspective. And I think one thing that's important is to not lose sight of in these legacy fields that he included infield drilling of existing fields as new high-cost light oil production. So when you start to categorize where should things fit and what tax level should they be at, you got to look at the total context of these presentations and take it all into consideration. The last statement there is, you know, the scary part for us is we've heard yesterday is the term harvest. If you're an Alaska resident, if you have a company here, you're vested here, it's a pretty scary prospect to just give up and say we're in the harvest mode. Last year, a senator, you know, made a statement to us that if taxes were 0%, he didn't feel it would change the decline curve. And to me, that's someone who's decided we're in the harvest mode. And I don't think Alaska in general feels that way. And I agree with Senator Stebbins yesterday saying it's a large resource, it's very valuable, maybe more valuable today than it was when it started, and I can't see us giving in to the harvest mentality. Van Muir stated, you know, the main reason for major companies to be in a harvest mode is that projects outside of Alaska are more attractive. No large attractive projects available in Alaska under current fiscal terms for major oil companies. And I think this in some way was supported yesterday by PFC Energy, and specifically them showing us how a 100,000 barrel per day new production attempt would be challenging under the current system. I haven't been to either one of these locations, and I'm not losing employees to either one of these locations, but they were used and they've been talked about in some of the dialogue with the Department of Revenue, so we put them in here. You know, one thing these two areas did do was drop Gabon and Trinidad, Tobago, they dropped their rate about 12% in order to attract new investment. I think if you go look at some of the PFC Energy slides and see where we fit in, they do have Gabon on there. There are so many different approaches to stating government take, total government take, effective tax rate, marginal tax rate. I've given up on trying to dissect and understand everyone's description of these various entities, what that means to each one of them. But so I just said, look, you know, I'll just use marginal take and we'll stick with that as far as the PFC Energy slides go. You know, if I just look at that as a layperson and say, where do we stack up? You know, these three are on there. And according to their slide, you know, we're marginal take here in Alaska is 80%. And that's, it's a little over 80. We just couldn't tell how far it went past the graphic line. And Gabon and Alberta is in the 50s. So I got to say, well, you know, then why do I have any expectation to be competitive with those areas on an investment basis? And so the details behind all of this and how we put ourselves in a better position on that chart is the challenge before the Senate. And I realize it's not an easy solution. As someone said, if it was, it would be done already. You know, when we talk about the viscous oil, and I say again, Pedro refers to it as heavy. You know, he indicates that for us to be competitive, we'd have to be in the range of 55 to 60% on government take. And, you know, you look at Schrader Bluff, you look at West Sac. I mean, you know, viscous is a part of our reality today. This is not some future technology breakthrough. These are investments being considered today. I think Scott Jepson testified to that on West Sac. And so when you take all these numbers and you roll them in and say, how do you address all these various types of oil streams and not create a tax nightmare to figure out for both the state and industry, you know, it just seems that we've got to come up with some lower overall tax structure across the board that induces investment. If there's a better way, I'm sure everyone's ready to hear it. Exploration, you know, we have benefited as service companies this year supporting new entrants into the market here for exploration. You know, the credits have stimulated a lot of exploration. I think like a lot of you, we would like to see this investment by the residents of the state in the form of credits lead to future production. And I think that's the big question for all of us. You know, what's the return for the $800 million or whatever the number is tied specifically off to exploration? We need to get more production in the pipeline, and hopefully the exploration investment made by the state will pay off. I mean, Pedro did point out that's one area that we're right at the top on is sharing the geologic risk here. And the hope is that will lead to long-term opportunities. But I think some of this exploration, even if it's successful, is not going to be enough by itself to significantly curb the decline that we're seeing today. You know, I think we just have to rely on the experts. It doesn't seem that 192 would do a lot to simplify tax structure. I think after being here yesterday and hearing testimony from PFC, probably the largest concern is that it doesn't do enough to stimulate new investment either from legacy producers or new ones. I think the higher cost light oil is what we're faced with. That's our future. Whether it's infield or outside of existing legacy areas, it is going to be more costly to go get. When you look at some of these West Sac type wells and you're looking at the long laterals, fracking is now reoccurring on the slope some. You know, it's a very expensive prospect to go out there and drill some of these wells when you compare them to North Dakota or other areas. And then lastly, reiterating, ACES does seem to inhibit the development of new projects, and the PFC slides go into some great detail on that. And, big challenge is, where do we share both the upside and downside? And I don't think anyone reasonably as an Alaska resident wants to see us upside down at low prices, or have, no income at all to the Treasury in a low-price environment. But I think that, we need a partnership on the tax structure that works at both ends of the spectrum, the low side and the high side. And I think if we solve the high side as well as the low, you'll get agreements from somebody of what's reasonable. Decoupling is a bit of a complex issue for us, but obviously from a high level you can tell it's probably in the state's best interest some point in time if we can do that. With the current tax structure, we recognize investments down here already. We wouldn't want to see something happen that would further increase taxation on industry and put us farther apart from our competition. So any decoupling, we just ask to be looked at to try to be somewhat neutral. Our second point is, we don't feel the current bill in its current form does enough to substantially change investment behavior. If something passes and became law that did not change investment behavior, it truly is a giveaway. So I think we either have to decide we can do enough that would change investment, and if not, maybe doing nothing's the answer. We've touched on a lot of points from Dr. Bamir's presentation. Some of his ideas are intriguing, but we're not supporting a total rewrite of the tax code and trying to get all of his points in to pick the winners and losers and determine what streams should get what type of benefit. And there's a lot of methods to go about and levers you guys can pull here. I think it'd be nice to see something come out of the legislature that if PFC did a reevaluation of where we stand in the future, that we would be in the middle of their chart somewhere and be competitive, and that Alaska, would be somewhere in the future, the header of a piece of paper like that versus North Dakota. I think we have the opportunity to see us do that somewhere down the road. That's the end of our presentation, and answer any questions you might have.
Just a couple of things for the information of yourself and then folks watching at home. On slide 11, there's a reference to Gabon and Trinidad. And we've asked PFC Energy to take a look at those two districts. Actually, there were four of them on Peter Van Meer's chart. Pick those up along with the discussion of Alberta and Texas and some of these other comparative locations, along with the North Sea, because we've worked, through PPT and ACES, and we've had a lot of comparisons done with the North Sea and other areas. But anyway, so that there'll be more information coming on that. I just talked to them late yesterday afternoon on that subject, so it's kind of on point to what you brought up in slide 11, just so we can flesh that out. But initially, I think you'll find that we have done some of the stuff that Gabon and Trinidad has done to try to stimulate additional incremental investment, but there's still, as you referenced, some concern from PFC that we still need to make some adjustments. And then in another subject, just as a kind of a comment, because I know that when we discuss about the issues with labor, that if your business, a Little Red Services, ran out of work, it's much more serious than the guy next door that happens to pick up some work, still issue of, the guy unemployed, it's a depression to him, it's not a recession. But we don't have the ability to drill down into like the service companies and parse them out and look at which ones are being employed or unemployed or we have to look more on the macro level across. Same dealing with the, for instance, the three majors. We lump them all together. We don't really know the intricate details, the differences between the two. When we set our policy, we have to set it broadly and then let the marketplace, you know, shake itself out. So I recognize that, that, you know, even though the employment numbers are at the max and the bunkhouses are full and so on and so forth, there's still the issue of the incremental production. And it takes a different type of workforce to deal with those, the incremental production issue that's in the middle of the table. So it's just looking at, you know, and I don't know much about Little Red Services, but just from hearing your testimony a few times, it appears that your firm is kind of in that category to get more probably negatively impacted than, say, a company that does that's leading to some of the full employment issues.
Yeah, just a quick response there, Mr. Chairman, is, you know, we've been very, very fortunate as a company, and probably more so than most of our membership, that our employment's been relatively flat at this point in time in the last few years. And, you know, flat is a win for us in a declining production arena. But I think that when you look at the more concerning issue for all of us, and it's bigger than Little Red Services, it's about Alaskans in general, is your point about, you know, their production issue, despite the heavy jobs numbers that we're seeing. And I think that's the problem we're trying to get to, is how do we get more production? If you look at these facilities that are operating with a lot of gas and water cut, and you look at the manpower of one of those facilities, the same manpower levels needed to produce a lot more oil through the same facility by having a better well stock to select from. And if you could bring on better oil producers and close in some of the high water cut, high gas rate wells, you know, your manpower levels and those flow stations and GCs and CPS remain substantially the same, and we get a lot more incremental oil for that work. So I think, you know, that's the real challenge before us as a state is how to get more for our money.
Okay, do we have any other questions, comments from the committee? Okay, thank you, Mr. Smith, for coming in today, and I see you've been here, I don't know how many times, was it 17 or something you'd mentioned? Wasn't you that mentioned in your presentation how many times you've been down?
There's been members here on 10 different occasions during this session. I've been here half a dozen times or so.
Okay. I'll probably be here a couple more, at least one more probably.
If I can afford a ticket, I'll be here.
Okay. Okay. With that, we're up to the last invited testimony. Mr. Rick Rogers, Executive Director of the RDC, but where is the fella?
I'm right here on the phone, Chairman.
Okay. If you could introduce yourself, I thought you might be hiding in the hallway afraid of the Finance Committee, and I was just going to encourage you that we're not that bad to come on in and testify. So if you could go ahead and introduce yourself, and who you represent, and it's a little more difficult when you're on the phone, but we'll do the best we can. Go ahead and put your testimony in the record, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair Stedman and Hoffman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Rogers. I'm the Executive Director of the Resource Development Council for Alaska, RDC. RDC is a statewide membership-funded nonprofit trade association, and we represent the common interests of forestry, fishing, tourism, mining, as well as oil and gas industries in Alaska. Our membership is a broad cross-section of the Alaska business community, including the aforementioned industries, as well as communities, all 12 Alaska Native regional corporations, organized labor, utilities, and support businesses that recognize the important role resource development plays in our economy. RDC thanks the committee for this invited testimony, and I do apologize for not being able to be with you in person today in Juneau. I recognize it's a little more challenging here on the phone. I really appreciate the LIO and the staff here in facilitating the testimony today. I have no slides for today's presentation. RDC is appreciative of the committee's recognition of the need to improve the investment climate in Alaska's oil and gas industry and stem tax throughput decline. I hope to emphasize, as I did in the resource committee, the sense of urgency and the broad base of support from RDC membership towards meaningful adjustment to the production tax to achieve a more attractive investment climate in Alaska. Some of the most vocal proponents of production tax among our membership are not directly involved in the oil and gas industry, and I think, like you heard from the Alliance, it's a broader concern for Alaska from the business community that we're fearful of what continued tax throughput decline means for our economy as a whole. We are convinced that ACES in its current form is retarding investment and contributing to the accelerating production decline. We feel that Alaska really is sitting on the edge of a fiscal cliff, and we acknowledge some of the sobering projections for the budget moving forward that's in the governor's budget document, including a 10-year budget projection showing several plausible scenarios with significant deficits in the near future. While meaningful tax reform will result in short-term revenue declines, long-term it's imperative that we sacrifice some short-term tax revenues to reinvigorate production. From RDC's perspective, this is about acting in the long-term interest of Alaskans. That long-term discussion needs to be on how to encourage more production. Taxing ourselves to prosperity is not a strategy. The current committee substitute, Senate Bill 192, is drafted. We don't feel provides improved business climate that results in the needed improvements of the investment climate to lead to this increased production. The changes in progressivity formula are insufficient to change investment behavior. We've heard this from both the industry and Department of Revenue, as well as some of the consultants that have come before the committee. The allowances for new production in the bill seem to have minimal impact. Looking at DOR's testimony on March 14th, the notion of rewards seems like a sound approach, and like progressivity, needs to be more substantive. I'm not familiar with the details of the tax holiday that the AOGA referred to in Kara's testimony, but it may be worth further vetting with the committee. The gross minimum tax is a tax increase up to $400 million per year at $40 per barrel, according to the bill sponsor statement. And according to the bill sponsor statement, it's a tax increase if prices up to $70 a barrel. So we're concerned that tax increases are not going to lead us to stimulating investments. It's a historic turning point for Alaska, and I know there's been a lot of rhetoric, and it's a difficult issue from a political standpoint. But we don't look at this as a giveaway or that legislators need to stand up to. We think that unfortunately mischaracterizes the objective. The Senate Finance Committee is faced with making some really tough choices necessary to empower the private sector to increase Alaska's productivity that will benefit all of its citizens. And we're looking forward to the Senate Finance Committee providing leadership necessary to make meaningful reforms that will result in the needed investment in resulting production. You admittedly have a very challenging task in front of you. Ironically, the bill as currently drafted really is a giveaway because it doesn't meet the goal of increasing production, which I think we all agree is the ultimate objective. RDC is interested in meaningful results that move the needle, slowing and reversing the production decline. As currently drafted, we don't think this bill gets there. PPT and then ACES tripled production taxes going back, if you start at 2005, and contributing to an accelerating production decline in spite of robust oil prices. DOR analysis suggests this bill makes little difference compared to ACES, so tripling up while tweaking down is not going to get us where we need to be to provide the investment and increase production. Some have suggested that meaningful tax reform that really makes a difference to the investment climate is somehow inconsistent with Title VIII of Alaska's Constitution. I don't recall Governors Hammond, Sheffield, Cooper, Hickel, Knowles, or Murkowski being accused of failing to uphold Alaska's Constitution when they had far lower oil and gas production taxes than we have today. These governors provided under a more presided under a more balanced fiscal regime, and RDC encourages this legislature to return to a more balanced fiscal regime for the mutual benefit of Alaskans and industry. This is not to suggest that we support going back to ELF, but clearly we need to do something more substantive than where we are today as currently drafted. RDC is on record in support of HB 110, and our primary reason for that is we saw the producers respond and commit to $5 billion in new investments if meaningful reforms such as HB 110 passed, and they said that the $5 billion was just the start. Now, I understand some have characterized criticized the validity of those commitments. However, I can't envision rational corporate strategies that would make those types of commitments publicly and then not follow through. Investment decisions are based on a multitude of variables, few of which the Alaska legislature has any control over. Alaska is one of the highest cost jurisdictions in the world. Alaska has immense challenges due to limited infrastructure, federal jurisdiction over wetlands, limited drilling seasons, and other hurdles. Companies need to assess project economics on all of those variables, and burdening production with taxes that are too high has discouraged investment. We should be in a boom at $120 per barrel, but we're seeing flat investment and associated accelerating decline curve. ConocoPhillips Alaska capital investment is flat in Alaska, and it's increased 104% in the lower 48 between 2010 and 2011. Now, I understand that the Senate has rejected HB 110 and has chosen a different path. RDC does not care which legislative vehicle gets across the goal line. We do care that it's substantive, significant, and makes the objective of encouraging private capital to return to the slope. The legislature is setting the stage for Alaska's future. Will it be a future of accelerating declines or a flattening decline curve and eventually increased production? SB 192, if that's the vehicle of choice, it needs to be far more meaningful in the adjustments to progressivity or adjustments to other so-called levers to approximate a revenue curve more in keeping with HB 110. RDC is grateful that the exploration credits are working and have not been reduced or removed in this committee substitute. Exploration is one important element. However, exploration credits need to be part of a broader approach leading to increases in near-term and long-term production. When new oil is found, we need an investment climate to encourage its production, or we're not going to see the ultimate benefit to Alaska from those credits. Geology, federal regulatory oversight, remoteness, high cost, short drilling seasons, volatile commodity prices are all out of the state's control. The bottom line is tax policy is one of the few variables in the Alaska oil and gas business that the state can control. We're going to get what we ask for. If we continue with a policy that discourages investment and directs it elsewhere, Alaskans better start battening down the hatches, as I fear we're entering a very dark time for Alaska's economy that may make the 80s look like a walk in the park. A better approach is to make substantive changes that result in compelling fiscal terms, including leading to robust activity to slow and reverse the production decline. This discussion is about what's best for Alaska, not what is best for the oil and gas industry. The oil and gas industry has the capacity to do great things in Alaska. We need to set the stage and then turn it loose. We didn't get to 16.5 billion barrels of production by being timid, so RDC suggests it's time for bold action to get Alaska back on track. The producers are the ones making the investments, and there are many places for industry to invest, and Alaska does have to compete. Consultants can and have offered helpful direction, but ultimately the companies at the end of the day are the ones who are making the investments. We urge you to listen to them and take to heart the criteria that the companies need to look at when deciding where to invest. As we heard from the Alliance today, RDC agrees that we are not ready to accept that Alaska is solely in a harvest mode. We have hopes for a brighter future for Alaska than simply writing down the decline curve. And we really look forward to continued progress by this committee on this very challenging issue in addressing this problem. So, Chairman and members of the committee, that's the extent of my prepared testimony, and I thank you for inviting us to share our views with you today.
Okay. We're seeing no questions or comments. Thank you, Mr. Rogers, for participating today. That,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
I've got a question.
Senator Ellis has a question. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rogers, thanks for your testimony this morning. As you know, the state has a base tax rate of 25%. Does the RDC, or what would you recommend to us as the ideal base tax rate from the perspective of the members of the Resource Development Council?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, it's difficult to comment, I guess, on one particular piece without looking at the whole package. So I guess it would depend on, you know, what the progressivity formula looks like, and, you know, the entire regime and the entire structure.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Seeing no further questions, I did have you on the list of the Anchorage LIO, but I had it buried in my other paperwork here, so I apologize for the very beginning, looking for you in the room when, you know, you were in Anchorage. But anyway, that concludes today's meeting. We are not going to have a meeting this afternoon because we finished up the invited testimony. The next meeting will be Monday, March 19th. We're going to take public testimony on the CS for Senate Bill 192 resources. So that'll be at 9 a.m. Monday morning. Meeting adjourned.